Lori Brado joins us this morning. Hello, Lori. Thank you for being with us.
Hello, thanks for having me.
I'm watching this interesting debate going on in the media in advance of the drugs that will be coming out next year that are supposed to be able to help a women's libido. A lot of men talking about women's sexuality.
That's true. There's been a long tradition of that, and although there are more and more women studying and working within women's sexuality, there's a much longer history of men studying it.
And is there a bias or perhaps a misunderstanding that those researchers bring to these topics?
There's perhaps a bias, perhaps more so there's the individual personal perspective of that. Mm-hmm. And even though every person who's studying this is an academic, they consume the science, they do the large long-term studies to make their conclusions, you can't help but bring your own personal perspective to the conclusions that you draw. And so there's definite gender differences in how men and women think about and experience and do sexual desire.
I have a feeling that we're going to be reading much more about it, given the pharmaceutical push to try to get women to think about something they're calling low libido. Do you agree?
I think so, yes, definitely. There's been increasing amount of attention the last few years with testosterone, and testosterone, of course, went to the FDA for regulatory approval. It wasn't approved, but what that did was it opened up the door for a number of pharmaceutical companies to really aggressively search for the panacea or the cure for women's low desire. So we'll definitely be seeing and hearing much more about this.
And what's your view of those drugs?
It's mixed. I'm certainly recognize that there is a biological component to women's desire. There are many women who will say that after menopause or after their ovaries are removed or stop functioning, that they really notice a difference in their desire. So no doubt that there's a biological component to this. Mm-hmm. Whether or not these drugs are effective, however, for restoring desire, I think the jury is really still out. When you actually look at the studies, yes, there is a significant increase in level of sexual libido from the baseline, so from before women start the pill to after. But when you look at the group of women who are receiving the placebo treatment or the sugar pill, they also report quite a marked increase in their level of interest. So, you know, in the recent studies, somewhere around 40% of women in the placebo group will show an increase, and somewhere around 55 to 60% of women in the drug group. So even though there's more of an increase in the drug group, there's still a very strong improvement in desire in women who are simply getting sugar.
And that leads us back to the brain, which I find fascinating. Your work at the British Columbia Center for Sexual Medicine doesn't deal so much with the biological causes as it does the way we get in front of ourselves with the way we think about sex, correct?
Right. So all of the women coming through our center certainly go through a very comprehensive assessment, and that assessment involves biological measures. Sometimes we look at hormones. We certainly do a physical exam. But ultimately, what happens to the majority of those women is we end up concluding that biological or medical factors don't account for most of the difficulties in their low desire. And so that's why many of our women choose to take part in one of our more psychological groups.
I want to talk about what you do here, because first of all, wouldn't you agree that the women who take part in this would have to want to be able to create a better libido? They'd have to desire that sexual activity, right? They couldn't come under duress, or they couldn't come because your husband says you're just not interesting anymore. You'd have to really want this to be able to participate and get any results, correct?
That's absolutely right. In fact, motivation to get better, motivation to work on it is probably the best predictor of who's going to improve after treatment.
So then can we assume that women, say, even after the age of 50 in those menopausal years, should be able to expect a libido?
Should they be able to expect a libido? Part of what our work involves is expanding how women define libido. So if that means that expecting they should have a libido means expecting they should respond in the same way they did when they were 21, when they were in a brand new relationship, no, I think that that's that's a false goal to set that up for women. But what we do with all of the women is we spend a fair bit of time in the beginning talking about definitions of desire. We talk about the great variability across women, and that helps them to establish kind of a new expectation of where they would want to be. And then having said that, I would say absolutely it's possible for women across the ages to get to a place where they have a satisfying level of interest.
And part of that, as you said, is the acceptance that the body is intended to have sex. It's not intended to just dry up and go away and never be a sexual being again, correct?
Yeah, that's right. There's been a fair bit of research looking at people well into their, you know, mid-90s and beyond, and showing that people continue to have sex. Those who do have sex have better physical health, have better and happier relationships, et cetera.
All right. I want to talk about just a little, you know, what are you getting these women to do in these groups? Because I was particularly fascinated by the idea that meditation can be as effective as some of the drugs that these pharmaceutical companies are bringing out.
So the mindfulness meditation component is, as I'm sure you know, meditation techniques have been around for at least 4,000 years in the Eastern world. And among practitioners, there was never a doubt that these techniques work for a huge number of anomalies and just for simple quality of life. And over the last 30 or so years here in North America, mindfulness meditation has made its way into Western medicine, beginning with a portal through chronic pain and then extending to treatments for depression and anxiety and psychosis and child behavior problems. It's a standard component of care at many cancer agencies, et cetera, et cetera. So essentially what mindfulness the philosophy of mindfulness is it's based on present moment, non-judgmental awareness. And in speaking to the women who come through our clinics, it's pretty much the opposite of what they describe in their sexual encounters. They're not in the present. They're either their minds are either elsewhere on something non-sexual, or they're focused on the fact that they're not going to respond, and they're anticipating that disappointment. So there's a lot of judgment. There's a fair bit of not being in the present, and in turn, there's a lack of awareness of if their body is even responding. So there's a fundamental disconnect that happens, not to all women, but I would say to many of the women that we see. So it makes sense then that practicing mindfulness might be a helpful tool for these women who are reporting disconnection when they're being sexual.
What I find fascinating about that is, even if you don't study meditation or know anything about the ancient practice, just the idea of noticing what's happening and paying attention to the feelings in your body and the tactile sensations and what it feels like to kiss again can bring back an amazing spark.
Yes. It's kind of a no duh,
yeah.
You know. It's but it is very true that once you point it out to him, once you hold the mirror up and you point out the fact that, you know, we all multitask, our brains are taught to do this, our society reinforces us for being in multiple places at multiple times, and that's what technology is helpful for. It's actually extremely counterproductive when one is trying to be sexual.
How do you feel about just the, I've talked with many women about women's sexuality, and I'm always confounded by women who say that it, for them, the reason they don't have more sex is because of a past argument or a past hurt, or it's a way to wield power in their household, rather than just in the feminine way of sort of opening. They completely view sex differently now, as that's their cachet of goods in some way.
Yeah. I mean, it says a lot about desire, and it says that women's reasons for sex really stem from making a decision, as opposed to feeling, quote, horny in the way that maybe they did earlier, or it may be in the way that if they have a male partner that they do. So women take a lot into their decision-making in deciding, am I going to have sex or not? And certainly a past argument, even from several months or even several years ago, if it's continued to create a feeling of disconnection or even lack of attraction towards a partner, completely it can influence her decisions of whether or not to be sexual. Now, of course, we'd want to consider the other side of the coin, which is, Are there positive incentives for her to be sexual? Can she imagine herself, although perhaps not right now, feeling satisfied physically and emotionally, can she imagine that that is possible? And so there's almost this balancing of the pros and cons, if you will, and a decision is made in that moment to whether or not to proceed.
And you call it asking women to think about just a willingness to be receptive, to not have hard and fast rules about, no, Wednesday night is the only night and it's only every other week or blah, 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 to get rid of those rules and just be a little bit more abstract in their thinking about sex.
Right. Yeah. So it's finding that balance between complete structure and complete spontaneity. With respect to spontaneity, that's a complaint we have among many of the male partners who will say, you know, the only good sex is spontaneous sex. And then we point out to them, well, what else do you do in your life that's unplanned? They turn around and they say, well, yeah, okay, good point. Everything else is planned. So it's somewhere between that and the rigid, hard, fast rule sex must look like this because it sets up false expectations.
We're talking today with Dr. Laurie Bravo. This is a fascinating article in the New York Times describing her work. She's a registered clinical psychologist, and she's been working with women around the idea of sex drive arousal, and she's been doing it without drugs. We're going to start hearing much more about the plethora of drugs that will be approved by the FDA in 2010 that are supposed to help a women's libido, but Dr. Bravo is suggesting that it might start with something as simple as the way you're thinking. So Dr. Bravo, if you could leave our listeners with some thoughts about perhaps how they can begin viewing their sexuality in a different light, especially if they're among the 30 to 35% of women who really are distressed around the low libido, where would you begin?
Well, one place to begin, of course, is if just because you're not feeling in the mood, it's not a sign that you're broken. And that, I would say, is a very frequent first complaint that women will say when they come to our center, you know, I don't feel horny, I'm broken, give me something to fix this. And again, expanding your ideas of the definition of desire is really helpful. We often find that with a little bit of education, partners will leave our office and inevitably many of them will go home and actually have sex the first time in a long time. So that's one thing, is expanding the repertoire. Secondly, stimulation changes over time, and what may have been effective last year or 10 years ago or premenopausally may not be the same. So skin sensitivity changes, preferences change, et cetera, et cetera. And so being open, and of course communication goes without saying, to different techniques, to different kinds of stimuli that would evoke a woman's desire. And, of course, you know, the bottom line, many studies have concluded that the influence of the relationship is probably the most important factor. It far outweighs the contribution of hormones or medical factors, et cetera. And so if there are problems in the relationship, maybe the place to start is not sex therapy, but rather something in the relationship.
You know, it's fascinating. I was talking to a group of friends once, and one of my friends said, well, if... The biggest thing that my husband could do to help my libido is help with the dishes. And
yeah.
I laughed about it. But in some ways, you know, women, because at the end of the day, they've worked, they've made the dinner, they've done the dishes. And then after that, you're kind of spent. And
right.
Perhaps if there was a more equal power sharing of the chores at home, women would have more energy left over for that kind of thing.
Yeah, now if we could only patent that.
That's right. Put it in a little pill, put a pharmaceutical label on the top, and we'd be millionaires.
Exactly.
In the meanwhile, I'd love for people to know more about you and your work. Do you have a website that you could send people to?
Absolutely. So it's obstgyn/sexual health. So obstgyn/sexual health.
Thank you, Laurie. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye now.